Hello and welcome to Andrew's Answers, Life's Questions Answered on Kanza Internet Radio. I'm Dr. Rusty Andrews of Andrews & Associates in Manhattan, Kansas, and here inviting your questions to Andrew's Answers. You can email us at answers, that's A-N-S-W-E-R-S, at Andrews, Inc., A-N-D-R-E-W-S-I-N-C, .net. You can follow us on Twitter at Rusty Andrews, or you can check us out at the Kanza Internet Radio webpage at Kanza Radio, that's K-O-N-Z-A radio.org. Please remember that when we talk about answers to life's questions, all statements are intended to be helpful in a general way, and answers are of a general nature. They are not intended to take the place of personal counseling or input from a mental health professional with whom you would work directly. Send your questions in, and today, if you have questions about the specific topic of self-esteem, that's our topic for today. We'd love to hear from you. We are talking this morning with our special guest, Dr. John Fagin of Andrews & Associates in Manhattan, Kansas. He's a clinical psychologist licensed in the state of Kansas, and welcome to the program, Dr. Fagin.
Well, it's good to be here, Rusty.
We've talked about several different topics with you over the past, and we this morning are going to focus on the idea of self-esteem. And self-esteem seems to be kind of a it's in some ways it seems like a somewhat difficult topic to actually define.
Yes, it's sometimes difficult to define, and certainly impossible to measure objectively.
So, yet at the same time, it's an issue that many people identify as something that they want to deal with in therapy. Can you just tell us a little bit about how you perceive self-esteem, some things that you've learned about self-esteem?
Well, when I was in graduate school back in the 60s and 70s, we didn't talk very much about self-esteem. So much of what I've learned from just being on the ground, so to speak, working with people and coming to conclusions about what is important in mental health and how things develop positively or negatively. Self-esteem essentially has two parts, as I see it. One is a view of ourselves as a person inside and out. Sort of an objective, if we can, idea of this is what I am, this is what I am not, these are the skills I have, these are the skills I don't have, and that I would call identity.
Okay.
And then there's that, do we value that or devalue that, and that's what I would call self-esteem.
Ah.
It is not what we are, it's what we feel about what we are.
So it's in the interpretation within our own brains of...
Precisely. Yeah. Some people have confused it with the word conceit. Is a sense that I'm better than everyone else.
Mm-hmm.
Self-esteem, on the other hand, is much more I'm just as good as everyone else, neither better nor worse.
Yeah.
But I am unique. I am myself, and that is good enough for me.
Mm-hmm.
And that's basically what we would call self-esteem. I know who I am, and I like me anyway.
I like that term. I like me anyway. Yeah. We could all do with some of that.
You know, it's also sometimes confused with the word self-confidence, for example. And one of us might be very confident in our ability to play basketball, mm-hmm. and yet feel like a loser off the court.
Mm-hmm.
Or one of us might feel like we're an excellent student on campus, but we're a total dork when it comes to social issues.
Okay.
And so we can have sort of a part self-esteem, or we can have sort of a gestalt or an overall self-esteem,
mm-hmm.
in which we see strengths and weaknesses, and we accept that without overly harsh self-criticism.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So ideally, we learn what our strengths are, we appreciate that and enjoy that, we learn what our deficits, our challenges are, and we accept those. As being human, we're all
mm-hmm.
imperfect,
mm-hmm.
and we just make the best of it. We mm-hmm. sort of fall in love with a puppy that we pick up at mm-hmm. the pound, even though it's not a perfect dog,
mm-hmm.
and we love it anyway. Or we birth a child, and it turns out to be imperfect, but we love it anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of people have that ability to love a person or an object that's imperfect, but they have trouble loving themselves when they see their own imperfections. There's really kind of a double standard.
Mm-hmm.
I can accept you as you are, mm-hmm. but I can't accept me as I am.
Mm-hmm.
It's really sad, and it seems to come from early childhood and parenting.
Oh, really? And so what kinds of experiences might a child have that would blossom into low self-esteem as an adult?
Well, I'm sure we're all somewhat aware of the term bonding.
Yes.
When a parent first brings a child home from the hospital, hopefully there is a sense of symbiosis or reciprocity that develops where mm-hmm. one is just as interested in the other and mm-hmm. vice versa.
That connection.
That very special connection uh-huh. that begins at birth and yeah. sometimes even before birth.
Mm-hmm.
Children can recognize their parents within 24 hours mm-hmm. by sight and sound.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a sense of bonding and that begins even before birth, and hopefully it builds. To the degree that a parent makes eye contact,
mm-hmm.
smiles,
okay.
coos,
mm-hmm.
comforts,
mm-hmm.
the child begins to feel valued and safe.
Mm-hmm.
If a parent is harsh or rude or inconsistent, handles the child roughly, neglects the child for hours at a time, the mm-hmm. child begins to feel unsafe and, mm-hmm. and begins to wonder about safety mm-hmm. issues mm-hmm. at a very, very early age. So
you're really talking about issues that start, well, even before birth then. I mean, there's care issues of that bonding and that connecting with your child that certainly happen very quickly after birth.
Well, you're right. It does begin before birth, because a lot of it depends on the attitude that the person has about carrying mm-hmm. a child and mm-hmm. birthing a child.
Mm-hmm.
If a person is not in a good place in their life to bring a child into this world, they may worry or be angry or depressed throughout their pregnancy, and those brain chemicals can cross the placental boundary and upset a child before it's wow. even born
mm-hmm.
and set it up for a difficult bonding process.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. But we'll assume a healthy pregnancy, a positive
yeah.
attitude,
yeah.
a good bond.
Mm-hmm.
So then you have a child in the first year of life who gleefully responds to an adult and feels valued by an adult.
Okay.
Well, as language develops, the child learns even a more of a cognitive connection as opposed to an mm-hmm. emotional connection.
Mm-hmm.
Potty training is critical, whether the parent is harsh or whether mm-hmm. the parent is relaxed.
Mm-hmm.
Helping the child learn to play with toys that have a sense of mastery about them.
Okay.
Certainly gives a child a sense of, I can do certain things.
Mm-hmm.
I can make things happen.
Mm-hmm.
One of the most important things for a child to feel is a sense of being able to, I hate to use the word manipulate, but it's the word that comes to mind now,
mm-hmm.
that the child can do something and garner a response from the adult,
mm-hmm.
a sense of instrumentality that adults will respond to me,
mm-hmm.
which is very different than a sort of growing up in an orphanage where you may be fed and changed and your bedding clean, but no one really responds to you.
Mm-hmm.
When you cue them,
mm-hmm.
they only respond by the clock.
Mm-hmm.
So responding to a child's cues in the first year of life and beyond are very, very important processes. So that the child feels like they have a sense that the world will respond to me in predictable and safe ways.
So one of the things that you might tell parents who are interested in developing children, and this is sort of the indirect approach to self-esteem, but and developing children who will have a greater chance of having a reasonable sense of self-esteem, would be that in their first year of life, if they cry, if they indicate they need something, you should respond to it and take care of that need.
At least acknowledge that the child is signaling to you, even if you don't give in to the child's demands.
Mm-hmm.
At least
I
respond.
Hear you.
I
yes.
hear you.
Yeah. Which when you're 3 months old is maybe just a little pat or something, so they recognize that I've made this sound, I've done this thing, and my parent is paying attention to me, and they at least acknowledge, know that I'm in distress.
And I'm important.
Yeah, yes, very good. That's the thing that they're learning there, isn't it?
Yes.
That they're important.
That they're not just a piece of furniture that gets dusted once in a while.
Yeah. Okay.
So as language develops and we start to convey to a child in our social the overall social contact that a child has, or the specific interaction with parents and grandparents and siblings, the child comes to the conclusion, I'm a boy or I'm a girl.
Okay.
And begins to pick up from the context or from TV or whatever what it means to be a boy or a girl.
Mm-hmm.
So then they act that way.
Okay.
And the same thing is true if you tell a child you're big, you're smart, mm-hmm. you're strong. Mm-hmm. They tend to accept a parent's opinion unquestioning, mm-hmm. and then to act out what they are told they are.
Hmm.
So if you tell a child repeatedly you're a bad child, they will believe it.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have the intellectual capacity and the perseverance to argue with you or to convince themselves, I'm really not what they say I am.
And they'll find out what a bad child does and do that.
Yes. Mm-hmm. It's a training process.
Mm-hmm.
And so parents should certainly be very cautious about addressing misbehavior as misbehavior and not destroying the character of the child mm-hmm. in the process.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're a good child, but that behavior is unacceptable.
Yes.
So that becomes very, very important. Throughout the first 5 years of life, it is my opinion, after 30-plus years of working with people, that self-esteem is almost locked into place at kindergarten. Because okay. those are the developmental years when they begin to believe, I am this, I am not that,
mm-hmm.
people like me or don't like me.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not yet able to dispute that or, mm-hmm. or disprove what mm-hmm. someone else is saying. They sort of just swallow it and accept it and mm-hmm. believe it and live it.
Mm-hmm.
If a child walks into kindergarten with a sense of confidence and it's okay to leave the house and the family behind mm-hmm. and the teacher's going to like me and the kids are going to like me and I'm going to learn lots of stuff, they're probably bulletproof for life.
Wow.
But if a child walks into kindergarten scared, crying about separation mm-hmm. from family, scared of a teacher, scared of the peers, mm-hmm. a fear of failure,
mm-hmm.
it's going to be a long uphill battle for mm-hmm. that child.
So it really does place the responsibility on the parents to do their job as best they can. And that doesn't mean without failures, but that the overarching sense is that you're building your child up in reasonable ways, and there are, frankly, simple ways to do that.
And in today's society, where both parents are usually working, or in a single-parent home where certainly most single parents are working, your daycare provider becomes
Absolutely.
A critical issue.
Mm-hmm.
If you put a child in a daycare position where the providers are overwhelmed, if they're curt, if they're rude, if they mm-hmm. just don't have the time and energy to nurture each child individually, the child can really struggle with that, even mm-hmm. if we're giving them a good response in the mornings and evenings and on the weekends.
Uh-huh.
Certainly the parent is the most important mm-hmm. provider of mm-hmm. this information, but a child will listen to peers mm-hmm. and other adults to some
mm-hmm.
degree.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this becomes a real issue if mom and dad are continually fighting, or if there's alcoholism, or if there's extreme poverty or depression, where the child can't be nurtured, where the mm-hmm. child doesn't hear those positive mm-hmm. affirmations,
mm-hmm.
or where the parents are just unable to respond to the child when the child cues them.
Mm-hmm.
So the child gets the sense that things might happen, but it's chaotic. It mm-hmm. just happens unpredictably.
Mm-hmm.
And I have no control over it. I have no say-so about when I get a glass of juice or when I don't.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so that child learns to adapt by being very passive, and just sort of waiting for things to happen to them.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe hopefully thinking sooner or later someone will feed me, or perhaps being fearful. Maybe I won't get supper because mm-hmm. Mom and Dad are duking it out in the other room and the mm-hmm. police are here and I'm starving
mm-hmm.
to death.
Mm-hmm.
So those sorts of family environmental issues are very, very important. But the most important point I want to make right now is this unconditional positive regard. We've
yeah.
probably all heard about that.
Mm-hmm.
It's a sense you convey to the child, I value you, even if I disapprove of your behavior.
Mm-hmm.
That is probably the most important, that and just consistency.
Mm-hmm.
Probably the most important things that I could try to convey to mm-hmm. a new family.
Mm-hmm. And you made an important point, which is it is still possible and appropriate and even in a sense necessary to discipline a child in the best sense of that term and still give them unconditional positive regard. It's still okay to say, you know, that behavior is not something we do. We don't do that. you're a good kid, but don't do that thing anymore.
Certainly, certainly. I discipline carries so many connotations. I like the word teaching. I like coaching or teaching or mentoring children as a term to raise children, to show them if you want to behave that way, go to your room and do that privately.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to use bad words, do that in your room privately. The rest of us don't want to hear that. You know, that's not punishment. That's just saying there are certain behaviors you do in church that you don't do at the mall, and there are certain behaviors you do on the ball field that you don't do at grandma's dinner table.
Mm-hmm.
There is a certain time and place for all behavior. So if you want to misbehave, just go do that somewhere else. I don't want to see it.
Okay.
And that's not punishment. That's not that's not even telling the child that they're wrong or bad. It's just saying there's a time and place for everything.
Yeah, giving them some direction.
Ain't it.
Yeah. don't do it here.
Don't do it here.
Well, there was another thing you mentioned, too, that I wanted to follow up on, and that was the interplay between possible mental issues that the parents are dealing with. So if you have depression, for instance, a lot has been said of late about postpartum depression, and you're talking about a time when that bonding is almost critical for a child, and yet the parent may be psychologically incapable of performing that bonding. Would that be a fair statement?
Certainly. I mean, postpartum depression, by definition, is a female issue. And if mother finds herself going through that and she is unable to nurture the child effectively, she certainly needs to bring in someone to help her with that, such as a spouse or a grandmother or another care provider. And there may be social service agencies that could help with that. But certainly if a mother finds herself really struggling with postpartum depression, she needs someone to help her stimulate that child.
Yes, and so it's more than just an issue for her well-being. She needs the help to get past that issue herself.
Certainly.
Her child definitely needs her to be able to get past that, or at least have somebody in the home that can still do the nurturing.
She needs some support so that she can recover, but just as importantly, she needs support so the child is not injured psychologically in the process.
And dads can do that.
Certainly, absolutely. There's no gender issue here. One of the things that we find right around here in this area because of Fort Riley is that oftentimes a child will be born while dad is deployed. And so you have a single mother who goes through pregnancy and birth in the early stages of infancy all by herself. And she may be 18 years old. And this can be one big challenge.
Yeah.
In this culture where grandparents are still working, they're usually not so available to come and spend 6 weeks like a stay-at-home mother and grandmother was a generation or two ago. She could spend 6 or 8 weeks with the new mother and the new baby, and that would help. But now most grandmothers are working, and that's not available. So those issues of family become incredibly important in the first 5 years. Once the child starts kindergarten and is at that mental age and in that social exposure to other people, building skills becomes important. When they begin to see, I can't run very fast, or I'm the last one to learn my ABCs, or I'm the last one to learn to ride my bicycle, they start then, perhaps for the first time, to really begin to judge themselves. The conscience forms in the late third and early fourth year. They learn a sense of good enough and bad enough, or more morality, really, at age four in the conscience forms. But still within their own home, if they're not in extensive daycare, it's still primarily the family's response to them.
Well, let's take that opportunity to take a break now, and then we'll be moving on and talking about developing self-esteem in children, and the reason we're talking about developing the foundations for self-esteem in children is that it's very, very difficult to change that if it's not built when you're a child. Not impossible, but it's a lot easier to deal with it when you're a kid. So we're talking with Dr. John Fagen of Andrews & Associates in Manhattan, Kansas, and we will be back in a couple of minutes and have more of Andrews Answers right here on Konza Internet Radio.
Later, much later, we heard something. We didn't breathe for listening. Then footsteps on the back porch, creeping, then more confident. After all, nobody was home. A hand closed on the knob on the screen door to the kitchen and found it latched. We heard a little sawing sound as a file began to slice through the screen wire. Grandma reached down for something in her sewing basket. Through the darkness, I managed to notice Grandma's rocker was rocking and she wasn't in it. She was standing over me. "Keep just behind me," she whispered. I followed her across the room into the kitchen. Now we were by the door, and I heard the scuffle of heavy feet in there on the crinkly linoleum. Grandma turned back to me. Under my nose, she struck a wooden match with her thumbnail. She touched the match to something in her other hand. It sizzled. Then she leaned down and rolled it into the invisible kitchen. Explore new worlds. Find out what happens next by reading the book A Long Way from Chicago by Richard Peck. For other great book ideas, visit literacy.gov. A message from the Library of Congress and the Ad Council.
My name is Sue Smith. I'm 38 years old, and I work at a graphic design company. Which is funny, because I couldn't even draw a stick figure when I was a kid. But I met someone who told me, you know what? You can do anything if you really want to. And if the teenage me were here, she'd tell you,
I wouldn't be into drawing and art if it wasn't for big brothers, big sisters. Most kids from my neighborhood don't get into art. They get into trouble. But I was lucky because my big sister showed me early on that I didn't have to be like most people. And to the young me,
that meant a lot. My big sister's name is Sheila, and Sheila is the reason that this 8-year-old grows up to have an amazing job as a graphic designer.
Whether you donate money or time, you're helping big brothers, big sisters help a child. And that can last a lifetime. Start something today at bigbrothersbigsisters.org. Brought to you by Big Brothers Big Sisters and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to Andrew's Answers, Life's Questions Answered, here on Kanza Internet Radio. I'm Dr. Rusty Andrews at Andrews & Associates in Manhattan, Kansas, and we are continuing our conversation today with Dr. John Fagin, a clinical psychologist, also at Andrews & Associates in Manhattan, Kansas, and we're talking about self-esteem. And Dr. Fagin, you were just beginning to talk about self-esteem and its development in the little, slightly older child, a little past infancy.
Well, over the break, I was thinking, and I decided to back up just a little bit. I want you to imagine a parent who is busy quite a bit and only seems to notice the child when they are successful at something and then heaps praise on them.
Ah, yeah.
So the child may get the idea, I'm only valued when I'm successful. Mm-hmm. And so they may develop a very compulsive, competitive style to try to excel at everything because mm-hmm. that's the link mm-hmm. to get attention. Mm-hmm. Imagine another parent who's overwhelmed, and the only thing they notice is when the child skins a knee or is crying mm-hmm. or is ill. Mm-hmm. So the child
learns,
some
kind of crisis.
So the child learns mm-hmm. when I'm competent, when I'm successful, I get ignored. Mm-hmm. And if I have a problem, I get attention. Mm-hmm. And you might see that child become an adult down the road who always seems to have a problem mm-hmm. and sabotages any success they may have mm-hmm. because they learned for the first 5 years, that's how you link with people. Mm-hmm. And so it's a great challenge to parents to balance their attention to a child, both mm-hmm. when they're successful mm-hmm. and when they're not, but more important, to find them when they're doing nothing. Mm-hmm. And value the child rather than their behavior.
And both of those parents might see themselves as good parents because they're giving appropriate attention to the child. And they are giving appropriate attention, but they need more than just the attention at those times.
They're each giving them an important slice,
yes.
but not the whole pie.
But not the whole pie.
If any parenting book you read is going to tell you to praise your child, mm-hmm. praise their success, praise mm-hmm. them, praise them, praise them, it's absolutely the worst thing you can do. You should never, ever praise a child. That's kind of a controversial thing to say. Mm-hmm. But
you're going to explain it, and it'll make sense.
If you always feed a child with a spoon and you always keep the spoon in your hand, is the child really going to learn to feed themselves very well? Mm-hmm. Probably not. Remember the old saying, give a man a fish, you feed him for a day. Uh-huh. Teach a man to fish, you feed him for a lifetime. If you praise your child daily for 18 years, they will be as addicted to that as they are to any drug.
Mm-hmm.
And they will have no self-esteem.
Mm-hmm.
They will have what I call other esteem,
mm-hmm.
meaning that they're only valuable in someone else's eyes.
Mm-hmm.
So to the degree that you can stop praising the child and teach the child to praise himself or herself, that's what I call self-esteem.
Mm-hmm.
When a child learns, oh, look what I did, and I feel good about it. What do you think, Mom, or what do you think, Dad?
Mm-hmm.
I encourage parents to always try to draw from the child a self-appraisal before mm-hmm. they give the child any mm-hmm. kind of positive feedback whatsoever, mm-hmm. or negative feedback.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing. If the child can learn to criticize themselves fairly, not mm-hmm. unduly or harshly mm-hmm. or with self-hatred,
mm-hmm.
but simply to evaluate their own successes or failures and to form an opinion or a feeling about them,
mm-hmm.
they're well on their way to developing self-esteem.
And they learn to be confirmed by this other person as opposed to be initiated by this other.
Perfect, yes. Mm-hmm. It validates, yes, this is real, yes, this is important.
Mm-hmm. And me feeling good about myself is okay, and my parent says, yeah, you should feel good about yourself. You did a good thing.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. So it's very, very difficult to get parents to stop praising their children.
Mm-hmm.
It takes, you know, quite a few sessions of reinforcing that in family therapy and trying to, I mean, it's a trite phrase to say, well, son, how do you feel about that? Mm-hmm. How does that make you feel?
Mm-hmm.
And you use a variety of phrases of, you know, well, you know, asking the child, tell me what you did and tell me if that was okay. Tell me if that was good enough for
mm-hmm.
you.
Mm-hmm.
And you can get creative, use a variety mm-hmm. of phrases
mm-hmm.
to try to pull the child's own self-appraisal. Then you can validate it. But instead of praising at that point, you can just say, well, I'm very happy for you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm very excited about your success.
Mm-hmm.
I'm glad you feel good about what you did.
Mm-hmm.
You're affirming and you're acknowledging and you're joining the child. But who gave you the right to say it's good enough or bad enough?
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're the parent. You're not God.
Mm-hmm.
So my sense of creating self-esteem is to get kids to do that. And that's exactly what I do with adults, to get mm-hmm. them to, it sounds silly, but mm-hmm. to stand and look in the mirror and say, I'm a good person, whether I believe it or not.
Mm-hmm.
Or I'm a good enough person, even if I'm not perfect.
Mm-hmm.
And to do that repeatedly, they almost have to do it out loud
mm-hmm.
because the mind can trick itself. It will listen to old memories and old tapes far more than current cognitive thoughts. But if you verbalize something out loud,
mm-hmm.
it somehow gets processed differently in the brain
mm-hmm.
and it becomes more real.
And it goes into that same place where all those other tapes are.
Well said. Anyway, we had talked about we're getting into the school system now, and the
mm-hmm.
child begins to see in a competitive situation because classrooms, let's face it, are competitive. Kids get attention for being the first one to learn this or to do that the
mm-hmm.
best, and they get their paper up on the board. And the school system does value speed and success in
mm-hmm.
learning, and so the kids who aren't the best begin to question themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Well, maybe. And they tend to see things in extremes, in blacks and whites. And so if I'm not the smartest, maybe I'm the dumbest.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's very, very difficult for a child to say, I'm average and that's okay.
Mm-hmm.
So the classroom can be a very destructive process. If you get a teacher, especially a new teacher who's very motivated to try to praise children and try to evoke that sense of eagerness to learn,
mm-hmm.
eagerness to please the teacher is what it is. It's not
mm-hmm.
eagerness to learn. It's eagerness to please the teacher.
Uh-huh.
If you get that situation, that might work very well to advance the achievement of the brightest and the best students in the class. Won't change their self-esteem. They just know the teacher likes them.
Mm-hmm.
And they're learning quickly, but the rest of the class may begin to suffer.
Mm-hmm.
So as they learn those skills, you know, the first one to hit a home run, the first one to get a touchdown, those kinds of things at recess can really start to build a sense of prowess or instrumentality or, you know, wow, that felt good. I'm proud of myself.
Mm-hmm.
But the poor kid who has two left feet may be really in trouble
uh-huh.
in that case if they're not getting some sort of affirmation for what their strengths are. When I'm working with families, I try to help them find some skill for each child. A child should be an expert at something.
Uh-huh.
You know, one kid may value himself because he can play basketball the best, and another kid may or may not care if he can play basketball. In another situation, maybe that segment of society values the chess player. And so you're only important if you can play chess, and who cares if you can play basketball? Mm-hmm. So having a skill does not translate to self-esteem either, because that pride in one's skill doesn't become pervasive. Because I can play basketball well, I'm a good person. Mm-hmm. It just means I have that skill, but I'm still a loser in the classroom or in any other situation. Mm-hmm. So skill building is important, but it's not sufficient by itself. And even if someone is doing well, they can still have a tremendous secret fear of failure. Mm-hmm. So even if they're highly skilled at something, they can still be filled with just continual doubt and fear of being found out as not being perfect enough. Throughout those years, elementary school years, the school and the peers become pretty important. Skill building becomes pretty important, but then we hit the middle school years, and that's when clothing becomes more important: the right shoes, the right haircut, the right cell phone now. Mm-hmm. And that sort of thing.
Developing that identity of themselves completely separate.
Well, separate. The competition with peers, you know. Yeah. Can I keep up with my peers becomes much more important in the middle school years than it was in the elementary years. Mm-hmm. There it's more just skills within the classroom, a much smaller set. Mm-hmm. Where you get to middle school, you have larger classes, more kids, that really becomes a sort of a crucible. I don't know how many kids I've seen who were extremely successful through the sixth grade and then just absolutely collapsed in the seventh grade when they hit middle school. Mm-hmm. They didn't have the confidence. They didn't have the self-esteem. Mm-hmm. And teachers don't have the time and don't have the orientation towards individual attention and lots of praise and lots of directing. The child is supposed to validate themselves. They're supposed to organize themselves. They're supposed to get things done independently. Mm-hmm. And if you have a very people-pleaser child who does everything to please the teacher and waits for the teacher to tell them what to do and then does it and then gets praised, the demand for independent functioning in junior high can just be crushing.
So that's where you really might start to see the consequences of that overpraising of the parents on the child.
Absolutely. There's no one there to continue to hold their hand and tell them they're a good boy or a good girl. Junior high is the first time you're really expected to function much more independently. And if you haven't learned self-esteem by then, you can get lost and you can turn to a peer group for support, and they may not be their best influence. Middle school now is when kids are starting to smoke and drink, use drugs. It's much more available. Or they can just retreat. They can get lost in their electronic entertainment and just isolate themselves because that's the only place they feel competent. They can begin to skip school. They can begin to act out in a wide variety of ways, getting into fights. Some kids at that age are even thinking suicide. So middle school becomes the time when you really, really learn what the child is all about. What a child does at home, I never worry too much about, because that's influenced by peers and by parents, for better or for worse. What a kid does in the community, how a kid behaves at school is extremely important, because that's when you're seeing what the kid is all about.
And how they'll be as an adult.
Yes. You can make a lot of predictions. I come from a small town, and I've gone back to my high school reunion every 5 years. And one of the advantages of that is I was sort of a psychologist even as a child. I was very curious about people and what made them tick. And watching who was confident as a child and where they are today, there's an incredible correlation.
Yeah, for better or worse.
For better or worse, yes. Yeah. Those kids who had come to believe that they were okay are really doing well now. And those kids who wouldn't make eye contact, who looked down, who always made excuses, or who always put themselves down, they're not doing so well. 60 years later.
Yeah. It's amazing how much those formative, I mean, we call them the formative years for a reason, that there's so much that happens in the first 5 years. There's so much that then gets put into almost concrete over the next 10 years. And then after that, it becomes very, very difficult to make it different. Impossible, but very difficult.
The next big step, of course, is puberty in high school. Mm-hmm. And here again, you get that competition and that sense of either striving because you believe in yourself, mm-hmm. or striving to try to please other people,
yes.
or acting out in defense by mm-hmm. Retreating or using alcohol or drugs or getting involved in falling in love. Mm-hmm. You know, lots of kids begin to date incredibly intensely because it's one place where they can feel good, even though they feel like a failure everywhere mm-hmm. else.
If one person validated by that other still.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Other esteem. If somebody mm-hmm. loves me, I must be okay.
Yeah.
You know, and
I'll do whatever it takes to feel that from that person.
Perfect. I will give up my integrity. I will give up my values just to be attached to someone mm-hmm. else, just mm-hmm. to be valued by someone else, because someone without self-esteem cannot tolerate being alone mm-hmm. because they can't validate themselves. Mm-hmm. And so that's where you really see kids who may come from a good family, may have had all the benefits, so to speak, but if they don't believe they're okay, mm-hmm. they can crash terribly badly in junior high mm-hmm. and high school, mm-hmm. and wind up, the old saw is, you know, the banker's daughter married the down drunk, you know, because self-esteem is everything, and if you don't have it, mm-hmm. you can't tolerate people who do have it.
Mm-hmm.
If you think you're a loser, you're only comfortable around other people that you see as losers. Mm-hmm. If you think you're a winner, you're only comfortable around other people that you see as winners. Mm-hmm. And so you may start out in life with all the benefits, but if you don't accept that, if you don't validate yourself, you're going to wind up hanging out with people who are on the same sort of ladder of mm-hmm. success or confidence mm-hmm. that you are, mm-hmm. despite your appearance or your background. So that becomes very, very, very important. And then, of course, the next big step is leaving home and going off to college or getting a job. And there again, people really start comparing themselves to other people, perhaps more than ever before, because I am going to college or I'm not, or I'm going to the best college or I'm going to a junior college or I'm going to a trade school or I'm just going to work at McDonald's.
Mm-hmm.
And that sort of, am I good enough? You know, am I worthy? Am I marketable out mm-hmm. here in the dating and marriage pool? You know, if you don't have self-esteem, you may not strive for an adequate job, or you may interview poorly on the job. You may never get a good job if mm-hmm. you are very self-effacing or very doubtful, can't smile, can't make eye contact, mm-hmm. can't banter, mm-hmm. so to speak, because mm-hmm. you doubt yourself. Mm-hmm. You don't dress well if you doubt yourself. It's just everything works against you, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And so without self-esteem, your whole future can be sabotaged. There is a slice of our culture, though, that does very, very well because they are just competitive and they're people pleasers. They want to impress everyone. Mm-hmm. And so academically and occupationally, they may be extremely successful and yet feel terribly empty. Mm-hmm. It's all for show.
Mm-hmm. And they do very well as long as they are successful, but when they have a failure, then that is way worse for them than it is for someone who has relatively reasonable self-esteem.
Erickson talked about the difference between identity and roles that we play. The identity being this is who I am and how I feel about it, and role is like the job I have mm-hmm. or the place in society mm-hmm. that I have. There are lots of people who are sort of empty but wear hats, so to speak, and they're fine, like you just said, until it falls apart. You know, mm-hmm. their spouse dies or they retire or they lose their job for one reason or another, and suddenly there's nothing on the inside, and mm-hmm. what was sustaining them on the surface is gone.
Mm-hmm.
They suicide, or they just curl up and die,
mm-hmm.
because there's no reason to live. If you don't have it on the inside and you can't show it on the outside with success, then why be mm-hmm. here?
I remember talking to a gentleman. I know that we're jumping ahead in the lifespan, but he was the CEO of a very large corporation and had lots of people who reported to him, thousands and thousands, literally, of people that he was responsible for. And the day of his retirement, he said, he started to feel that, but it didn't really hit home until the next day he walked back into the office. Nobody paid any attention to him. And those thoughts of what do I do now and utter depression that were literally close to suicidal types of thoughts just overwhelmed him, because every bit of his sense of self-esteem and who he was came from that job. And of course, he got his gold watch, and the next day he wasn't anybody.
Back before World War II, back before mental health became much more available to the general public, and these issues became much more presented in the media to where people could be aware of them, a lot of men at 65 or 70 killed themselves. A lot of farmers went out to the barn and hung themselves, or a lot of people who left the railroads just walked out in front of the next train because they couldn't tolerate not having a job, because there was nothing inside to sustain them. Hopefully people have become more aware, and there's more support in our social system that the suicide rate won't be so bad. But a lot of widows and widowers just give up the ghost gradually, six months after their spouse dies. They just wither away for no particular reason, apparently. And that's part of that whole thing of being valued by someone else, what I call other esteem, as opposed to having a sense of this is my identity, this is who I am, and I like me whether I'm perfect or not.
Okay. Well, let's take another break, and we'll come back with the last segment of our program and talk a little bit more about self-esteem. Remember, you can send your questions to answers@andrewsinc.net. You are listening to Andrew's Answers, Life's Questions Answered, here on Konza Internet Radio.
Welcome. Who's this?
Hi, I'm Philip.
Hello, Philip. You sound really young.
Not really. I'm 9.
Oh, wow. You're still in elementary school, right?
Does that matter?
Oh, no, not at all. What's your question?
Well, I know the molecular formula for water is H2O. I also know that hydrocarbon is CH3CH250CH3. Glucose is C6H12O6. The general formula for an alkene is CnH2n+2. But what I can't seem to find is any scientific formula for Bob.
Bob?
My goldfish.
Are you ready for kids who eat healthy? Good nutrition can lead to great things. To find out how a healthy lifestyle can help your child succeed, go to mypyramid.gov. A public service announcement brought to you by the Ad Council and USDA.
When I have an asthma attack, I feel scared. It's kind of like an elephant is on my chest.
I feel like I'm choking.
Sometimes my parents have to take me to the hospital.
You know how to react to their asthma attacks. Here's how to prevent them. Call 1-866-NO-ATTACKS. Visit www.noattacks.org or call your doctor. Because even one attack is one too many.
I feel like a fish with no water.
Brought to you by the EPA and the Ad Council.
Rebecca Romaine. As a former model, I used to walk runways all over the world. Paris, Milan, New York. This is Felice Diarra. As a local health worker, he walks the pathways of his village in Mali, West Africa every day to help treat severely ill children. Like many children in the developing world, those in Felice's village are threatened by common illnesses that kill millions worldwide. But unlike villages without a local health worker, the children in Felice Village get the care they need to survive. And even though you can't walk in his shoes, you can help him with his work. Help one, save many. See where the good goes at goodgoes.org and find out all the ways you can help get the good where it needs to go. Brought to you by Save the Children and the Ad Council.
Thank you. Welcome back to today's final segment of Andrews Answers, Life's Questions Answered. I'm Dr. Rusty Andrews from Andrews & Associates in Manhattan, Kansas. You can send us email questions at answers@andrewsinc.net. And you can always check us out at Konza Internet Radio. Their webpage is Konza Radio, K-O-N-Z-A, radio.org. We're finishing our conversation for today with Dr. John Fagin, also a clinical psychologist at Andrews & Associates in Manhattan, Kansas, and talking about self-esteem. And Dr. Fagin, we've talked about self-esteem from the perspective of helping it build or be built with infants, children, through the early teenage years. And then now we're ready to talk about it some more in the as people become adults.
I first became aware of the importance of this when I was first in my career. I was working with very small children. That was sort of my mm-hmm. specialty. Mm-hmm. And I would ask kids, are you a good kid or a bad kid? Mm-hmm. And oftentimes they would say, I'm a bad kid. Or they'd say, well, sometimes I'm good and sometimes I'm bad. Mm-hmm. Well, if I tell you you're a boy, you're going to act like a boy. If mm-hmm. I tell you you're smart, you might act like... I mean, classroom research shows that if you tell kids they're smart, they'll do better. Mm-hmm. And if you tell them they're average, they'll do poorly. Mm-hmm. Kids respond to that kind of feedback. So basically, a lot of the therapy that I provided to these kids was to convince them that they were a good kid who made mistakes. Mm-hmm. But that they were never a bad kid. They mm-hmm. were just a good kid who made mistakes. And conveying that to the parents, because parents had been told by their parents or had learned, yeah, that's a bad kid, or mm-hmm. bad seed, or bad mm-hmm. blood. Mm-hmm. Anyway, as the child and the parents came to understand this is a good child, you know, morally upright child who makes a lot of mistakes, mm-hmm. they would take a much more pleasant attitude towards mm-hmm. the child and help the child correct the mistakes mm-hmm. instead of trying to punish the badness out of them. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the more you told a child that there was a good child, mm-hmm. That child would strive to be good because mm-hmm. that's what they are. Mm-hmm. If you're a boy, you strive to be a boy. If you're a girl, you strive to be a girl. Mm-hmm. So that was really the beginning of my understanding of the importance of self-esteem. What I learned in working with families and adults over the last 30 years is that every client who comes in and sits in my office has the same problem. They may think their problem is unique. They may come in with this problem or that symptom or this issue. But every one of them who comes to my office has poor self-esteem. And that is the majority of the therapy that I do with people, is simply to help them come to terms with who and what they are. And mm-hmm. because when people have that, they'll go out and conquer any problem they've got. They'll mm-hmm. do it assertively and confidently and persistently, and mm-hmm. they'll solve problems. They'll mm-hmm. find other resources. But if you doubt yourself and you expect that whatever you do is going to fail, or that no matter what you do, no one's going to like you, mm-hmm. and that you're always hiding and pretending to be something that you don't think you should be, mm-hmm. then life becomes very difficult and chaotic. Mm-hmm. And you tend to, like I said earlier, tend to sabotage a lot of things. So much of what I do is, you know, if someone comes in a crisis, obviously we deal with crisis.
Right.
If they come in with a specific problem, we deal with that. But if they stay very long, mm-hmm. they're going to wind up working on how they feel when they do this, how they feel when they do that, mm-hmm. and how their life can be better, mm-hmm. you know, if they change their attitude mm-hmm. about themselves. Mm-hmm. Because if I love myself, Rusty, I'm going to try to see the best in everybody around me. Mm-hmm. If I doubt myself or hate myself, I'm always going to be on the lookout for the bad things in other people. Mm-hmm. If I like myself, I'm going to try to elevate you. If I think I'm a success, I want you to be a success too. There's an old saying, misery loves company. Mm-hmm. If I don't like myself, I'm going to try to bring you down to my level.
But the opposite is also true. Happiness and elevation loves happiness and elevation.
Certainly, certainly. We birds of a feather flock together. We have lots mm-hmm. of old proverbs today.
Yeah, yeah.
But you can tell what's on the inside of a person. I mean, at first, they may fool you with a good first impression and a good pretense or act mm-hmm. that they're okay, they're happy, mm-hmm. they're successful, they're mm-hmm. confident. But it doesn't take long to see that that's a veneer, mm-hmm. that it's really skin deep. You'll start to hear self-deprecating remarks, or you'll start to hear self-doubt, or you'll see that it's they feel competent in some areas, but they really dislike themselves overall. Mm-hmm. And so And the more someone tries to convince you how good they feel, chances are they don't.
But what you're describing, though, is a very positive approach. You're really going at this from a very positive perspective with the belief that that people will flourish. It's very Rogerian that people will flourish if they're given the support to do so and feel like they have it within themselves to do that.
When people feel competent, they identify problems and they tackle them and they resolve them. Mm-hmm. Or they learn this problem can't be solved, but that's okay. I can survive in spite of it.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't have to feel bad.
It's not the end of the world that this I can't do this.
Or that, okay, so I'm divorced. Mm-hmm. You know, that's not a personal flaw. That's a life situation. Mm-hmm. Or my child went to jail. You know, mm-hmm. I can live with that. I can survive that. That's the mm-hmm. child's problem, not mine. Mm-hmm. So most people, if they grow up with what we call other esteem, mm-hmm. you know, striving for the approval of the peer group or the family or the workplace, whenever there's some threat, they feel very down because mm-hmm. they can't get that approval anymore. Mm-hmm. So it just feels rather empty or they feel rather worthless. Mm-hmm. If you can help them instill within themselves a sense of self-worth, no matter what happens to them, mm-hmm. and that they should respond to what's on the inside rather than responding to what's on the outside, mm-hmm. then people can become remarkably resilient. Mm-hmm. There's a new Army training program I just read about the other day called the Master Resiliency Program, mm-hmm. where they're teaching soldiers to not respond to situations, but to learn to sort of reframe situations and to see, say there's a battlefield situation and bad things happen. They teach them to look at who survived and what they were able to accomplish and to keep a more positive attitude and to value themselves and what they did, as opposed to feeling out of control and chaotic and feeling guilty because mm-hmm. something happened. Mm-hmm. They're teaching them to stop and think and take a positive attitude no matter what they're mm-hmm. in. Mm-hmm. And that I love to see that because we have so many PTSD situations coming back from the battlefields mm-hmm. because soldiers didn't have that sense of self-esteem and self-worth. And mm-hmm. so when something goes wrong or something is traumatic, they tend to absorb that. They tend to carry it back home with them. They can't shrug it off. Mm-hmm. because there's not enough on the inside to counterbalance what happened on the outside. Mm-hmm. And so now the Army is not calling it self-esteem. They're calling it master resiliency training.
Sounds better.
Certainly, certainly. And it looks like it's going to be very effective to help soldiers see themselves realistically mm-hmm. and not to have too many expectations of themselves as superheroes from the comic books, mm-hmm. the G.I. Joes of the world. Mm-hmm. They're humans. You mm-hmm. know, they do what they do and live with it. Mm-hmm. And not to take it to heart so personally or to mm-hmm. feel like a failure, to feel such a sense of loss. Mm-hmm. That they were human before they went, they're human when they came back. That was an experience. It doesn't have to change them.
And it sounds a lot like, or part of what you're talking about seems like the idea of what you can control and what you can't control, or that internal locus of control, that sense of, I have efficacy to some extent on this situation, and it comes from within me, not my circumstances.
An excellent point. People with self-esteem have an internal sense of control, a locus of control. They have a sense of value that stays with them no matter what happens outside of them. Mm-hmm. People with an external locus of control strive to get that approval from other people. They're mm-hmm. overly reactive whether they get it or they don't mm-hmm. get it. They're overly reactive mm-hmm. to any threat to their appearance of competence mm-hmm. because they don't really believe it. Mm-hmm. And so anything that seems to take away from their the way they appear to other people as successful or not successful, that's an external locus of control, and that makes them very, very dependent and vulnerable. Mm-hmm. If I need your approval to get through the day, then I will kiss up to you. I will be dependent on you. Mm-hmm. I will be completely vulnerable to the whims. Whichever way the wind blows that day makes it a good day or a bad day. Mm-hmm. When you have self-control, You have like the ballast in the bottom of a sailboat, that no matter how much the wind blows and tips, mm-hmm. the ballast in the bottom of the sailboat brings it back upright again. Mm-hmm. But if you don't have self-esteem, you don't have any ballast in the bottom of your sailboat, and every breeze will tip you over and leave you there.
And I would imagine, too, that then one of the consequences of that is that a person might be more hyper-controlling of things in their environment, trying to set everything just exactly so, and everything must be exactly this way. Not necessarily to like an obsessive compulsive disorder, but something along the lines of being what Freud would have called a very anal person who has to have everything just so around them, because that makes them look better, but it's not coming from inside them.
If you don't have that internal sense of worth and you depend on other people to sort of make you feel good or make you look important or give you a sense of validation and approval, then yes, you're always going to be trying to control your environment and trying to control other people that mm-hmm. isn't controllable. Mm-hmm. That's also the foundation of domestic violence, mm-hmm. trying to force other people to treat you in a certain way so mm-hmm. that you get that affirmation and feel good. Mm-hmm. Certainly, if you're the kind of person who hurts other people, you don't have any self-esteem to begin with, and you're going to feel worse afterwards. Mm-hmm. But if you believe that your good feelings about yourself come from other people, as if you were still 3 years old,
yes,
then you're going to try to control situations, events, people. Mm-hmm. You're going to put undue pressure on other people. Please make me happy. Please make mm-hmm. me feel good. Please don't hurt me. You're so externally driven that your humanity just begins to mm-hmm. dissipate. You're just a thing that's always trying to control or trying to suck up to people, kiss up to people to please them mm-hmm. so that they will give you that sense of validation. Mm-hmm. But a person who has self-esteem is almost impervious to the opinions of other people. Mm-hmm. You know, I will listen to your opinion. I will consider it very carefully. Mm-hmm. But your opinion really doesn't count until I agree or disagree with it. And mm-hmm. then it becomes my opinion.
Yes. And I'll pay attention to myself.
Absolutely. Yes. I will listen to what I say to myself about myself.
Yeah.
Because I'm the only one who really knows me.
Yeah. And that is different, and this would be a hard thing for some people as adults to grasp, but that is different than selfishness. And in fact, selfishness actually is probably more an outgrowth of the low self-esteem as opposed to the higher levels of self-esteem.
Absolutely. A person with high self-esteem is very generous, mm-hmm. very empathic, mm-hmm. And generous in an anonymous way, mm-hmm. meaning that they are not being generous to seek recognition mm-hmm. or a plaque on the wall. Mm-hmm. They are generous because it's the right thing to do, mm-hmm. and it helps them feel even better about themselves to help other people to feel better about themselves.
And perhaps they see it as an expression of who they are, and they've decided who that is.
Absolutely. You might remember Maslow's hierarchy of needs
yes.
that he published back in the 50s, maybe the 40s, mm-hmm. When Maslow first started publishing. And it's self-esteem is very, very high on that hierarchy of needs. We have mm-hmm. to satisfy our needs for survival mm-hmm. and connectedness to other people mm-hmm. In order to really begin to have the time and energy to see ourselves as we are and to value ourselves as we are and to nurture ourselves. Once we achieve that level, then we can truly become a citizen of the world who cares about other people, mm-hmm. who cares about the politics, who really has a genuinely empathic or altruistic mm-hmm. caring for the world around him or her.
Very good.
It's not just to please me anymore. It's to take care of this world we live in.
Yes. And Maslow's hierarchy of needs, interestingly, sort of follows that progression that you talked about from infancy through to adulthood. So, well, I'd like for us to talk some more about self-esteem and the treatment of self-esteem and ideas for adults of how they can work on their own self-esteem, things that they should have in their heads. And we'll do that in a future program. But at this point, we're out of time, and I want to say thank you, Dr. John Fagen, psychologist at Andrews & Associates in Manhattan, Kansas, for participating with us today and bringing us all of that great information on self-esteem.
Well, thanks for having me. I enjoyed it.
Remember, you can email us questions at answers@andrewsinc.net. You can follow us on Twitter at Rusty Andrews, and you can check us out at the Konza Internet Radio webpage at konzaradio.org. This is Andrews Answers, Life's Questions Answered. It's produced by Megan Andrews, and I'm Dr. Rusty Andrews from Andrews & Associates, inviting you to stay tuned for more programming right here on Konza Internet Radio.